I'm glad to introduce Dietrich Dietrichsen in his talk Before and After Science, Ethnology, Translation and Gossip in Hubert Fichte's Contribution to the Genre of Travel Writings. Dietrich Dietrichsen will explore the experimental practice by German writer Hubert Fichte, his canonic and anti-canonic educational journeys to the South, a tradition Fichte reinvented in the process and through his oeuvre. Dietrich Dietrichsen is an art theorist, cultural scientist, publicist, and professor for theory, practice, and communication of contemporary art at the Akademie der Bildenden Künste in Vienna. He's known, among others, by his publications on pop music and the sopranos. He's currently curating, together with Anselm Franke, a project on the practice by Hubert Fichte in the context of the Canon Fragen long-term project in Hakave. Please help me to welcome Dietrich Dietrichsen.
Thank you very much, Paz and Anselm, for inviting me here. The travel writer. The travel writer is somehow a mix of a colonialist and a refugee. He's a distant artist, but he's also often an involved witness, a reporter. He's trying to escape the limits of the canon, trying to get away, but he's also conquering new material and including it into the canon or into what is already known. And these two activities in relation to canon and canonization are, of course, themselves part of a genre, of a tradition, something that is canonized. So, Before and After Science, Ethnology, Translation, and Gossip. Hubert Fichte, the writer and traveler I'm talking here about, was different from most people we normally evoke in debates on canon-related questions, not skeptical of this category, the category of the canon, nor the general practice of listing normatively essential cultural matter which everyone should know. When his publisher, the Fischer Verlag, started a series of books called Mein Lesebuch, or in English roughly, My Textbook, they asked all their well-known authors to select the crucial texts of German literature that they thought were essential and should be read by everyone. And Fichte replied in a typical, ambivalent, twofold way. First, by giving a list of his canon, and that not only in a surprising way, but also in a very aggressive typeface, an aggressive layout. Every name was one sentence. Every name was name, full stop, next line. Name, full stop, next line. Name. So the names were Homer, Sophocles, Homer, full stop, Sophocles, full stop, Petronius, full stop, Nizami, full stop, Villon, Rabelais, Quevedo, Marlowe, Defoe, Casanova, Stendhal, Flaubert, Strindberg, Lagerlöf, Proust, Euclides da Cunha, Genet, Borges, and so two ancient Greek, one Roman, one Persian, six French, one Spanish, two British, one Italian, two Swedish, one Brazilian, one Argentinian, but no German author. And he continues by arguing in a text written in Dakar, in June 1976, while on a research trip to investigate the methods and institutions of West African psychiatry, that there is no such thing as German literature for the following reasons. There is A, no connection between German writers. They are not referring to each other in the way Genet refers to Proust, who refers to Racine, who refers to Seneca, who refers to Euripides. Or a Brazilian candomblé practice, which refers to an African practice, which refers to a practice that, according to Fichte, has even been described by Herodot. There's also no author people in the rest of the world learn German for, except, and that is also true in Senegal, where he's right now, except for these authors, Hegel, Marx, Kant, Freud. But this is no literature. Theory is a fiction, he wrote in another place, but only about the people who write it. A book by Hegel is a book on Hegel. This means fiction with only one voice, and that is poor compared to other novels, which have more characters. And not even for Goethe do people learn German? Fichte asked in a rhetorical mood. No, not the writer, only the institute. But then he does indeed compile a German textbook. It has A, German Baroque literature, the most forgotten and alien part of German literary history, and one repressed by homophobic aesthetics, as Fichte argues. B, translations. Translations and some theoretical texts now by very famous authors, like Goethe, Thomas Mann, and so on, but only their translations. And third, texts that one could refer to as anti-German and or ethnological. And here the outstanding examples are a text called The Negro and another one called The Indian, both by Franz Kafka. So we come back to Fichte in a while. I said he was a traveler. He traveled almost without interruption from 1966 to his death in 1986. For long stays in, among other places, Portugal, Brazil, Venezuela, Belize, Nicaragua, Chile, Argentina, Venezuela, Suriname, Trinidad, Panama, Grenada, Haiti, Jamaica, Florida, New York, Morocco, Algeria, Benin, Togo, Senegal, Tanzania, Bahrain, Sweden, and France. He obviously wanted to expand the canon, not only beyond Germany, Europe, the West, but also he learned plenty of languages and he wanted to obviously understand, if possible, all languages. And of course the only framework for that, the paragon, as one could say, and using a category that has been used this afternoon, was the genre of the adventure story. To travel means to alienate. It is a procedure to either make yourself alien for the world around you or to make the world alien for yourself. In both cases, we talk about procedures which seem to artificially and deliberately recreate the conditions upon which the concept of Western individualism and thus author-based art is founded. Conditions of singling out, of distinction on the basis of subjectivation. No wonder the legion of novelists being travelers. But already in the narrative which accompanies and legitimizes the tradition of apprenticeship by traveling journeymen, this experiment with individuation has become institutionalized by the institutions of knowledge and skills acquisition. You had to do these journeys as a journeyman in order to be a proper craftsman. Learning people make long trips to acquire knowledge, mostly in form of other forms of production and other skills, but they're also expected to acquire maturity and character by the double game of becoming a stranger for others and making your immediate surrounding strange for you by traveling and thus changing it. By implementing this trick, the less is finally strange around you, and the continuously more refined strangeness within your subjectivity has been sublimated into maturity and skillfulness. Within the German literary tradition, the German canon, this is mirrored by two classical and one can easily say canonical journey destinations in the south, Italy and Spain. Both reappear as competing holiday destinations for German mass tourism in the 1950s till today. For Renaissance artists and later for the self-educating young bourgeois, Italy was the place to study beauty, described and framed by different theories and ideologies of beauty. Whereas Dürer and his contemporaries went to Italy because they had to, in order to learn from the most advanced production of beauty of their time. Goethe, when he went, only had to register already existing beauty and could spend the rest of his attention with complaints about bad administration and the dubious psychology Italians are suffering from in compensation for the abundance of natural and cultural beauty. But the celebration of light and meaning, of an enlightened and thus meaningful beauty, which was always the reason for the Italian journey every educated German had to do, produced a counter-movement which started in the early days of Romanticism and became strong in the late 19th century, the journey to Spain. Spain had a dark beauty as opposed to the enlightened beauty of Italy. Whatever darkness meant in each specific Romanticist persuasion was indeed not decided, but it was a critique of rationality, of the also the rationality in the all-too-quick success of the travel strategies when traveling to Italy, of Goethe's consumerist pleasures. Making yourself strange should not as easily turn to such distant and uninvolved aesthetic enjoyment, accompanied with German arrogance about a deficient service industry. The types of knowledge that you acquire by alienation and its eventual overcoming would have to be more cathartic. Otherwise, the whole genre of travel writing would fall into decadence. The protagonists of the Spanish journey were advocating depth, and they liked the sentimiento trágico de la vida. They liked fanaticism and radicality, be it an anti-rational death drive in tauromachia or just political radicalism. It was shared, actually, by French travelers. This Franco-German line connects the romantic German translators of the Spanish classics with art historians like Müller-Gräfe and surrealists like Georges Bataille. And later Spain, of course, was also the territory where the German fascism and had its testing ground, but also armies of voluntary communists and anarchists fighting Nazi fighter planes and each other in the Civil War. Hubert Fichte started, if you wish, third German and anti-German travel tradition. He was a child of the he was born in 35, but as a writer, kind of a product of the 50s, he was one of the person who were whose protege he was Walter Höllerer, a translator and a person who collected, who kind of produced literary events, and he had invited him to Berlin, to the Literarische Kolloquium Wannsee, and there he met other contemporaries. And then in this period, Höllerer was kind of the person who imported Beatnik literature to Germany and who had helped to publish Ginsberg, Kerouac, and others. And so those were travel writers, and those were romantic traveling writers. And Fichte, when he read them, thought, I could do that better. And so he started traveling himself. He went to Portugal, that is a little bit further west from the other two destinations I mentioned. And there he wrote a book, but the first book was the first book that came out of travel was a book on his hometown, Hamburg. But behind Portugal, as Stanley Kubrick would have said, behind Portugal there was infinity. Or as Fichte had once called it, the total other. The misleading category ethnopoetry, which was applied to Fichte several times, has categorized him often along the line of other methodologically ambitious travelers of surrealist provenience, like, next to Bataille, for example, Michel Leiris. But although such a fan, as we've seen, of French literature, Fichte rejected this, quote, Bataille, Leris, Bastide, they were all colonialists, unquote. He declared in a crucial reflexive moment of his 900 plus pages novel Explosion, the novel of ethnology. In this novel, the writer Jackie and his photographer partner Irma pass through three transformations. In the first part, they arrive, 1969, as tourists in Brazil. And one could maybe say that the first concept of traveling and learning is connected to craft. The second concept is the mechanization of these effects of the traveling journeyman who learns a craft, the mechanization of the effect of learning through traveling, which is then in educated bourgeois writers. And the third version is, of course, the industrialization of this procedure, which would be mass tourism. So they arrived there as mass tourists. They came with a mass tourism organization, Neckermann, and arrived at the Copacabana in a tourist hotel in 69. To overcome the dreadful state of being tourists and to finance their stay in Brazil, they became journalists. They tried to sell their articles and photographies to several different German magazines and journals. And, and the novel has a lot of debate about if it's worse to write for Spiegel or worse for Die Zeit. And that in Die Zeit at least treats, or Der Stern is even worse, but Der Stern even treats photographers decently and gives them credit, whereas Der Spiegel doesn't even do that, and so on. But they learn quickly about the failures and the lack of freedom of that form of production, and deciding at the end of part one to become something else, some kind of scientists, some kind of, it needs to get more objective, more real what they're doing. In the spirit of the era, think of Althusser, science seems to be the only reliable and decent form of the alienation and de-alienation process at the basis of knowledge production and acquisition beyond accumulation and industrialization. In the second part, they decide, now in Salvador, in the state of Bahia in 1971, to become ethnologists. The transformation is now felt differently. It does not only apply for the change from a profession vis-a-vis the Brazilian reality to another profession, like from tourist to journalist, but also to the deeper identitarian kernel that had made the first two possible, namely writer and photographer. That's what they are beyond being journalists and writers or literature or poets. Quote, should I really refrain from being a German author who ponders over train stations in Hölderlin and become a full-fledged ethnologist? Unquote. Would the writer as a basis disappear once the critical journalist becomes an ethnologist? And would that be possible? But the second part of the novel also proves it is impossible to become an ethnologist. Instead, it is necessary to write a novel about ethnologists themselves and all the other ethnologists who hang out in the extended Brazilian field between Rio de Janeiro, Salvador da Bahia, Belém, Manaus, Recife, and São Luís de Maranhão. Especially about the strange relation between Fichte and Fichte's alter ego character Jackie and the well-known French pope of Bahian ethnology, the photographer and ethnologist Pierre Verger. The character Verger, in an exposed moment of this novel, makes a statement on his involvement with the Brazilian, the Afro-Brazilian Candomblé, which he's not only a photo documentarist and ethnologist, but also an important leading priest and religious authority. Quote, I do not make photographs anymore these days. The more you know, the less you want to document. The more you know, the less you ask. Unquote. Hmm. In the third part, they finally become, after these doubts of the methods of Verger that I will come to come back to later. In the first part, they finally become something like veritable ethnologists, but 10 years later. In the meantime, they have been in nearly every other part of the world, and then they have to return to Brazil where they started the ethnological exploration. And they come now to other parts of Brazil, especially in São Luís de Maranhão and other parts of the Brazilian Northwest. They do a kind of real, serious ethnological exploration. But this has a lot of consequence for the generalizations I made in the first place about travels and the German canon of types of travel. They have an effect on three underlying research questions that the novel exposes. First is how transparent is translation. Second, the dialectics of truth and secrecy. And third, will sex be the answer, in brackets, or the ideal medium of translation? First, how transparent is translation? Ethnology is for Fichte the science of translation, not only for Fichte, also for the character Jackie in the novel. Not the structuralist grammar of culture. In a polemic essay, not within the book, but not in the novel, but elsewhere, he accuses Claude Lévi-Strauss, and then in the novel, the entire French school of Afro-Brazilian ethnology, of a cultural colonialism based on the ignorance of the languages of the people they are talking about. The alleged ignorance vis-à-vis these languages leads to the structuralist overestimation of relations and social rules, which Fichte tries to correct with what one could call a semanticist approach. Quote, has he ever asked one of the people living in the Tropique whether they are really triste? No, he hasn't, because he couldn't. He did not speak their language. Unquote. This alleged French arrogance installs into the very logic of traveling and travel writing, which I exposed in the beginning of this talk, a kind of artificial petrification. The initial alienness of the traveler who resists the dynamism of slowly acquiring more and more familiarity. Instead, this is not possible because he's not learning the language. Instead, it implements a static mechanism of formal description, which can continue forever. It doesn't change because there's no learning involved. This petrification, called structuralism, is leading, according to Fichte, to a permanent distance between ethnologist and ethnological object, and by that, to the false category of objectivity of science, which has no place in ethnology, according to Fichte. Instead, it should be replaced by the self-reflexivity of a novel on ethnologists, in which ethnologists become characters. This would expose, as in the novel, is exemplified by the character Pope Pieri, based on Pierre Verger, the primordial libidinal nature of ethnology, the sexual or quasi-sexual desire at the heart of social relations, which everyone knows about and include every social being, but not the ethnologists. They do not acknowledge this, at least not about themselves. So Fichte finds out that Pierre Verger preferred black-skinned lover, just like Fichte, but he did not believe this would be a part of the truth conditions of his ethnological findings. Sexual desire is just another meaning, just a signified, not a signifier. And thus, so Fichte's, one can say, not totally unbiased view of Saussure and structuralism, not of any importance for French ethnology. Second, the dialectics of truth and secrecy. Not only the traveling writer makes herself or himself alien to the social world around her or around him when traveling, and the social world alien to him or her by going to unknown places and cultures, the production of alienness through opacity is a common feature of truth procedures, as argued, for example, by Edouard Glissant. One of its tools is secrecy, as has been studied in detail, for example, by Georg Simmel. The Afro-Brazilian religious practice of Candomblé, which is important for this novel that I'm talking about, is, among other things, shaped by a virtuous and complex culture of different stages of secrecy. So different from a world that is just strange and alien because the traveler had not seen it before and arrives there for the first time, Candomblé and other Afro-Brazilian and indigenous cultural strategies, which are already based on experiences with colonial repression and slavery, are actively making themselves strange to the stranger and to the local outsiders as well. To a large degree, they do that because of those experiences with repression, but also they do it because the controlled revelation of truths is only possible by speech acts that are based on the previous keeping of a secret. Only after you had installed, kept, and cultivated secrets and secrecy, a controlled release of truths in the form of revelation or other religious formats is possible. Fichte was impressed, fascinated, and also critical of this operation, which he did not describe in such abstract categories. Rather, he articulated time and time again how the practices of Candomblé and similar others based on diasporic Yoruba traditions at the same time seem to be an expression of cultural difference, a legitimate celebration of something that is to be respected by agreeing to not fully understand, and at the same time a procedure that in its truth claims wanted to be understood, and was on the level of universal ideas of understanding and sameness. The rituals and their protagonists remind him, for example, of the Catholic nuns in the orphanage he grew up in, or of the salon of Madame Verdurin in Proust's Recherche. Both social practices which have this in common with Candomblé, the dialectics of secrecy and revelation, of closet and gossip, which for him was at the center of his question. How he could be at the same time so deeply attracted by rituals and dreaming of a world, and at the same time dreaming of a world completely free of rituals. The absence of rituals equals freedom is the title of one of the last interviews he ever gave. But the colonial asymmetry in structuralist alienist to meaning does not go away in a semanticist world of translation. Not only because language is not transparent, a structuralist truism which is not reserved to structuralism, but also because the two sides of translation are not existing in an egalitarian context, which the procedure of translation suggests. Can the association with Madame Verdurin in an act of Candomblé be reverted? Third, is sex the answer? The secret of the ethnologist, according to Fichte, is less their asymmetrical status of an unmarked observer. It is their desire, their libido. There is a societal institution that relates to that secret in the same way that religious rituals relate to the truths of religion. This institution is called gossip. Fichte is gossiping a lot, and thus creates a tension between the traditionally fictional space of literature and the religious space of revelation, of truth. Literature cannot reveal because the trace of subjectivity informs its language. Religion cannot invent because the suspicion that it's nothing but an invention is too strong. But gossip can mediate between truth and subjectivity, be it scientifically objective or ritualistically revealed. And if you believe Fichte's temporarily taken utopian position, it can also escape or supervene the colonial imbalance by its relation to sexuality. And that is, at least in the first two-thirds of the book, the good universality of sex. It is not only in this novel that, above all, male homosexuality is described as a code of tenderness that crosses all kinds of barriers. This utopian character is based on the relative privilege of men in many societies to enjoy a certain freedom of sexual experimentation. Fichte declares. He does not invest a lot of time in the critique of this privilege, but he sometimes concedes the same freedom to lesbian women, who play indeed a large part in the religious establishment of Candomblé. The relative freedom of men to enjoy a promiscuous homosexuality across all lines of ethnicity, tradition, and even libidinally driven by the desire to meet and love others is, of course, surrounded by many dangers to turn into its opposite, exoticism, for example. But Fichte insists on the relative validity of the utopian character of male homosexuality because of the special role it has in religious secrecy and ethnology, both being just masks for an almost already liberated character of exchange beyond exchange value. In part two of the novel, the director of the Goethe-Institut in Salvador de Bahia explains to Jackie he can only get to know anything about Candomblé if he lets himself be initiated. This is the only way. And Fichte replies, no, I don't need to do that. But it's the only way. What else would you do? Well, I could sleep with them. And then Fichte comments, that was too much, even for the progressive director of the Goethe-Institut. In the final part of the novel, in the third part, Jackie no longer really believes in this, let's call it, hippiesque gay liberation idea, what he called the Verschwulung der Welt. Actually, interestingly, Fassbinder used the same term, and I tried to find out who coined it first, and I couldn't find it out. I don't think that the two of them have taken it from one for the other. I think they both came up with it at the same time without referring to the other. He has already in earlier stages of the novel described how organized sexual masterism has turn exactly this potential into a commodity. He is constantly watching the development of the Spartacus Guide, which is in the beginning some kind of a samizdat, underground fanzine-like publication, and is already kind of a glossy book in the early 70s, into a tool of the tourism industry. In the last part, Jackie and Irma practice a relative classical ethnological approach to several Afro-Brazilian practices, and no longer is the role of sexuality that important. It's only important in on the level of content, the question he asked people, but no longer it's no longer the underlying important force. Jackie has a plan for a huge literary project of 25 volumes. The contemporary and post-European version of Proust's Recherche. In the first sketch, which is mentioned in the early part of the novel, it is called The History of Tourism. Tourism being the origin and the end of the global sexual utopia. Later, Fichte really starts this project, and the novel I'm talking about becomes volume 4 of 18 books that he manages to complete before his death in 1986. But the title is now different. The title is now The History of Sensitivity, Die Geschichte der Empfindlichkeit. And in order to save Empfindlichkeit, the idea of a radical revelation by sexuality had to be dropped. The science of ethnology and the religious ritual will have to be reconsidered as a means of protection. But gossip as the main instance of self-reflexivity is still more valid than ever. In a manifesto about the crisis of the humanities, the sciences of the mind, as they are called in German, Fichte argues that only an ethnologist who is able to write a sentence like, I'm learning Wolof because I'm gay, is worthy of his discipline. But that also means that the ultimate goal of gossip is yourself. And if yourself becomes the object of gossip, then you are back in good old autobiographical subject-oriented literature, confessional, autobiographical. And not only that, you're also, in a way, complicit with the social rules that provide the veil for the gossip that you use for your revelation. And that is, of course, a problem. And this problem they are kind of talking about in another in another novel of that cycle of novels, which is a very melancholical, short novel, kind of novel on methodology, and it's called Forschungsbericht, a research report, in which they kind of run into dead ends with their ethnological project in Belize, and they are betrayed by cab drivers, and other problems arise, and just about to drop the project of continuous traveling. And then in the moment of catharsis, they decide to get rid of the narrative, get rid of truths and truth procedures, get rid of secrecy in order to nobilitize or legitimize revelations, get rid of the ways around the world, but just keep two elements of the travel literature project, and that is the leaving, the running away, the leaving home, and the other is be everywhere at the same time, be omnipresent, be ubiquitous, and that is the kind of desperate utopian attempt to save, and at the same time, of course, to leave that genre, that project of travel literature. Thank you.
Thank you. The conversation on the canon and the anti-canon is, of course, challenging also for our time frame. So I invite you to adjust this frame and join us for a 20-minute break in the Café Global and continue a discussion there. The HKV gong will remind us and invite us to come back to the third panel, Limits Hallucinating the Canon. And let's thank the great talks by all these speakers.